how she had haunted Lucian long before her death, and how she was now galvanized to his soul forever. "I know." He started to fall forward, but I caught him before the shotgun fell to the floor. He leaned against my shoulder. He weighed about as much as Katie.
"Spend most of my life trying to decide whether to shit or go blind. Guess I made up my mind to do both."
I laughed until there was a warm, soft lump in my throat and a heat behind my eyes. I palmed the Damascus-barreled coach gun from him and gently lowered the two hammers.
"Don't worry. We'll get you cleaned up."
It didn't take as long as I thought. After I got him in the bath, Lucian was able to seat himself on the specially constructed seat. I was stunned at how old he looked. Small, naked, and drunk. I watched him as he clung to the stainless steel help bar and allowed the water to cascade over his scalp and carry the bad things away. The dent where Mari Baroja's uncle had finally settled the matter of Lucian's one and only marriage was evident. The water pooled there like some little eddy in his life and collected memories that refused to be erased. I patted the old man on the shoulder, closed the curtain, and sat on the seat cover. There was a fresh copy of the Durant Current on the floor next to the toilet brush. When I picked it up, I noticed that it had been carefully folded back to the obituary page. I sighed and looked into the black and white of Marie Baroja's obit. She had died on her birthday. That explained the drunken jag. I dropped the paper on the floor and went back to the main room to give the poor man a little privacy. I took the soiled chair and put it out on the patio for future cleaning. The Datsun truck was still warming up, and as I slid the door closed, I could see the ghost of myself in the reflection of the glass. Or maybe it was the real me trying to whisper in my ear and tell me what it was that was specifically rotten in Denmark. There were other eyes out there, other shapes that shifted and fell away, only to drift back up from the falling snow to watch me and see if I was going to get it right. These shapes moved softly in the deep snow and between the trees. They provided no insight, just audience. I thought about Vic, who was doing my investigative work. I should let her go home. There wasn't any reason I couldn't stick around and gather what little information needed to be gleaned here, my daughter notwithstanding. I went back to the partially closed bathroom door. "Hey, Lucian." I heard some shuffling noises. "You're not going to drown if I go tell Vic to go home, are you? I don't give a damn what you do." I took the beer with me. On the way back to Lewis's office, I discovered Joe had replaced Jennifer at the front desk. He looked much as he had two nights earlier when I had fought the Christmas tree. He wheeled his chair back and stuck his arms out, blocking my passage to the bottle brush conifer. "Very funny. I just didn't want you to risk electrocution again." I leaned against the counter and listened for a second. "How come there isn't any music?" "Aw, shit!" He fumbled under the counter with the stereo system, and pretty soon Gene Autry was crooning Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. "Joe, do you have any idea what could have happened to that container of Metamucil?"
"I'm sorry, Sheriff, but it was just on a shelf in the main supply closet. I showed your deputy where it was supposed to be, but a lot of the clients get in there. None of the stuff is prescription, but we try and keep everyone's name labeled on them."
Vic said Shelley Gatton didn't know anything about the missing container. She had seen Lana the morning I had seen her, after her grandmother had died, and the day earlier when she had brought Mari lunch along with the cookies. She said Joe Lesky was less helpful in that he hadn't seen anyone with or without cookies, and that when he showed her the supply closet, there were four containers of the Metamucil, but none with the name of Mari Baroja.
"You going to test them all?"
She absently pointed to the cans that were on top of her jacket in a brown paper bag. She had been kind of surly about where I had been for the last hour, but got over it when I handed her a beer. I watched as she ate the rather bland meatloaf, limp green beans, and pasty mashed potatoes she must have been served quite a while ago. "You didn't get me any dinner?"
"You want mine?"
She took a sip of her Rainier. "This beer's not very cold." I watched her play with the meatloaf, trying to give it a palatable posture on the turquoise plastic tray.
"What are we going to do next?"
"The cookies were clean."
"Will you give up on the fucking cookies?"
"I wish we had them now."
An elderly woman on a walker paused at the doorway of Lewis's office long enough to register a dirty look. Maybe it was the language, maybe it was the beer, or maybe that was the way she looked at everything. I noticed that the cans of Metamucil had been opened. "You already started testing these?" She nodded.
"It doesn't smell like they've got anything in them, which means they probably don't have anything in them."
"Well, so far that's pretty much representative of the case. Where there's smoke, there's smoke." I thought about all the things that needed to be done. "Could you throw a check on the terrible twins and see if anything turns up? I realize it's a long shot."
"I already did. Kay's clean as a whistle. And Carol's been involved in some questionable deals down in Miami, but nothing that leads me to believe that she'd be capable of something like this."
She continued to study me.
"Walt, trust me. I'd like them for this, but there's just nothing there."
I stared at the window until she spoke again.
"Now what's the matter?"
"I'm resigning myself to the wonderful homecoming I'm giving Katie."
She crossed her arms and considered me.
"Yeah? Tell her to come out to the Moretti Mobile Manse by the motorway and listen to the wind and the 18-wheelers jake-breaking, then she'll appreciate what she's got."
I looked at my recently divorced deputy, a beautiful, intelligent woman with a body like Salome and a mouth like a saltwater crocodile. I had been to her house trailer when I had hired her, but that was the last time I'd been there. I started to wonder why she hadn't ever invited me over for dinner, when it came to me that I had never invited her out to my place either. I guess it had never really occurred to me, even though I continually swam against the undertow of my attraction toward her. The thought of myself involved with a woman who was about the same age as Katie was an image so pathetic that I erased it in wide sweeps on a regular basis.
"You going home for Christmas?"
"No. Mom says Nona should be dead by then, or so she's promising. Vic Jr. got this new girlfriend, fiancée, who's a hairdresser and pregnant, and Alphonse is running off upstate with some friends. Tony's working at the restaurant with Uncle Al, and Michael said fuck the bunch of us."
We talked about her extended Philadelphia family on an infrequent basis. As far as they knew, the world stopped at the main line in Paoli. I had the most contact with her mother, had spoken to her on the phone a couple of times, and seen a picture of her once. Lena was languorously gorgeous with the same olive-skinned, exotic beauty as her daughter, but with a few more years on the vine to ripen. She had an equally handsome husband who, Vic said, pretty much ignored her mother. He was severe and driven and occupied himself with being the chief of detectives north, 6th District, and liaison officer with the mayor's task force on organized crime.
"How's your mom?"
She crushed the Rainier after the final swallow.
"She says I need a good fuck."
I nodded, sage-like, and looked at the crumpled can still in her hand.
"Maybe she's right."
"She says you need one, too."
She tossed the wad of aluminum in the trash can under the desk.
"Don't take it personally. It's been her advice on the human condition since Khrushchev pounded his shoe on the table at the UN. And Dad says it's always been the case."
"Something tells me your mother doesn't use the term good fuck."
"No, she uses the term roll in the hay. But it just doesn't have the same poetic ring."
I found myself becoming slightly aroused as it dawned on me that Vic probably talked dirty during sex, which shouldn't have come as such a surprise, since she did it in accompaniment with everything else.
"So, you think your mother needs a roll in the hay?"
"Since Khrushchev."
"That's a lot of rolling."
Her attention went back to the reports.
"Yeah, well, she's married to a super cop."
She didn't talk about her father all that much, but his influence was plainly felt.
It would have been easy to dismiss Vic's relationship with him as the difficulties a man with four sons had when confronted with a daughter. But his dealings with the four boys didn't seem any less rocky. She yawned. "Go home." I helped her put her coat on, and she turned and stood there studying me, looking nothing like a deputy is supposed to look. She grabbed the lapels of my sheepskin jacket and then smoothed them with the palms of her hands. "I still can't believe you're getting laid before I am." I exhausted a short breath, a reasonable excuse for a laugh. "If it makes you feel any better, I'm not." She picked up the containers of Metamucil and waited till she was around the corner and a couple of steps down the hall before calling out,
"It does."
When I got back to Lucian's room, it was quiet. The door was closed and locked again. I knocked. "Lucian?" There was no answer, but I could hear muffled sounds along with some splashing noises. "Hey, you getting bashful in your old age?" I listened and could swear I could hear more than one person in there. I glanced back down the hall where I had returned the passkey, but there was another sharp noise, and I was committed. I couldn't hear anything anymore, and a surge of panic raised my head by contracting the muscles along my shoulders. "Lucian!" I pulled my .45 out and crossed the hall. I knew from past experience that if I used my foot to break down the door, my foot would be the only thing that went into the room. I could hear more noises now, so I charged across and planted my entire side, shoulder first, into the door. It exploded and blew me against the wall beside the bathroom. I saw a leg move in the bathtub and brought my head around to see someone running up the hillside outside Lucian's patio. Someone big. "Sheriff, freeze!" He was gone. I rushed into the bathroom, my lungs settling as I holstered my sidearm, and bounced off the edge of the tub as I hit the slippery floor. The shower curtain was wrapped around the old sheriff's body, and the water was still running. I pulled the curtain from around him and cut the tap. His leg was still up on the seat, but the rest of him was lying on his side with a fist clenched at his chest. I reached under his neck and pulled him up from the accumulated water that, having been freed from the curtain, was now swirling down the drain. He coughed, and I turned his face so that when he threw up it would follow the water. It smelled like bourbon, and I held the one-legged man against my chest as he retched to a stop. He blinked his eyes and looked up at me. "What are you doing here? Go get that son of a bitch!" I grabbed a towel from the rack, placed it under his head, put him back down, and raced from the bathroom, through the main room, and out the patio doors. I pulled my sidearm, slid to a stop, and looked at the boot prints. They trailed up the hillside. It looked as though someone had brushed against one of the pine trees about halfway up the hill. He must have slipped but had regained his footing and had continued on. The Datsun pickup was gone. I paused at the edge of the parking lot, having been careful to make my own path up the hill. The tire tracks and the exhaust melt of the Datsun were still compressed in the snow, and I knelt to look at the boot print where he had gotten in the truck. All the prints were marred enough so that we'd never get a decent imprint, but I placed my boot alongside. Big, bigger than mine. Lucian had struggled up to a sitting position by the time I got back to the bathroom, and I was glad I'd shut the sliding glass doors. He was shivering and clutched his remaining extremities, so I propped him back up on his seat and wrapped another towel around him. I pulled a thick Royal Stewart bathrobe that Katie had given him last year from his closet and picked up one moccasin. I caught myself looking for the other one before remembering that he didn't need it. His prosthetic leg was leaning against the door, and on it was the other slipper. I snatched up the leg and continued back into the bathroom, where he looked up at me, still clutching himself. I sat on the toilet and wrapped the bathrobe around him, placing the leg against the tub, secure in the thought that this should be the order of things. There was a little blood in his smile. He must have bitten his tongue in the struggle. I pulled the old man in and tried to warm him up before looking for a phone. He was struggling with something, and after a moment his clenched fist came out from the folds of the robe, and he opened his hand. In his palm was an almost foot-long hank of jet black hair. The bloody smile held.
"Got a piece of him."
Chapter 10.
No one at the home drove a Datsun pickup. And the only one in our tax records was a rusted hulk out on the Miller Ranch down near Powder Junction. It hadn't run since Steve and Janet's daughter Jessie had planted it in an irrigation ditch back in '89. Steve told Ruby I could have it for the annual sheriff's auction if I came and got it. I gratefully declined. I sank my head back onto my folded coat and draped my arm down to pet dog. I was having a hard time getting Ruby to concentrate on the Datsun pickup rather than Lucian. How about the DMV? Except for the sound of the plastic keys, it was quiet in the office. Katie had left a message last night that she had gotten a ride from Henry and that she had arrived at the cabin safely. She also said that she and the bear had stopped at the grocery on the way out. She also thanked God that they had. She also reported that it had only taken 10 minutes to shovel out the living room and that Henry had used more duct tape to seal up the roof. She was asleep when I got there, and when I risked a kiss on the top of her head this morning, she hadn't stirred. The tapping stopped. 3. Locations? From my perspective on the wooden bench of the reception area, I could see the serrated clouds on the ridges east of town. The sky was a striped, fiery orange, and the snow between was pink. The thin, nimble fingernails, coated in lacquer, continued typing. Lusk, Laramie, and Lander. I gave out with my best Basil Rathbone and wondered about the location of Watson. I'm beginning to see a pattern.
They all start with L?
I held up an index finger. Perchance a clue.
Let's start with the closest.
Tapping.
Ivar Klinkenborg.
You're kidding.
Nope.
Wants or warrants?
More tapping. None.
Age?
68.
Next. There was silence for a moment.
Which is closer, Lander or Laramie?
I didn't answer because I wasn't sure. Vic and Cesar Vittoria had gone out to a vehicular altercation on 196 just south of town, and it was the Ferg's day off. The bear was MIA and was probably back on the res. I was idly thinking that at least I had dog when he got up and moved back over to Ruby. Let's do reverse alphabetical order. I got a look on that one.
Jason Wade.
Wants or warrants? Tapping.
1 DUI, 2 moving violations, both HPs, recent registrations from Nebraska.
This time I stuck a fist in the air. Go Huskers! The big red N stands for knowledge. Another pause.
Is that a no?
I threw my arm back over my eyes.
Height? 5'8".
Next. More tapping.
Leo Gaskell, 36, 3 moving violations, and a domestic violence charge from 2 months ago.
Even more tapping.
Involuntary manslaughter, did a 5-spot in Rawlins, weapons possession, processing, drug abuse violations, clandestine lab operation 5 years ago, did a year in Fremont County, more drug abuse violations. There's an assault on a law enforcement officer with no charges pending.
I was already up and watching her.
Height? 6'5".
Hello.
She looked over at me as I thought about it for a moment. Call up Bill Wiltsy in Fremont County and ask him what he knows.
It was quiet for far too long.
What? Had it occurred to you, as a trained and veteran officer, to get the license plate number?
I let out a large sigh in hopes that she would feel sorry for me. Maybe I'm slipping.
I slumped back on my folded coat. She took a sip of her green tea that I knew from one small sample tasted like lawn clippings. I rearranged my arm and pulled my hat down, knowing full well the silence was about Lucian.
He's fine, Ruby.
She exhaled a response, and I waited in the silent darkness of my hat. You're sure?
You couldn't kill him with a ball bat.
I thought about how Lucian had looked when I'd run him over to Durant Memorial, flushed with excitement.
He looks better than he has in years. If I'd known what an effect it was going to have on him, I would have tried to kill him years ago.
I waited, but she seemed satisfied.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Why did you lie about not knowing Mari Barroja?
It was quiet again. At that point in time, I thought it concerned Lucian's personal life.
I lifted my hat. Fair enough. I stood up and started down the steps to the little kitchenette in the basement. I'm going to go make coffee.
I'm sorry I lied.
I stopped on the landing and looked up at the painting of Andrew Carnegie, a leftover from the library years. All the time I'd worked with Lucian, he would salute Andy every time he went by. I smiled back up at her. It's all right. You weren't that convincing. I paused there on the landing and looked at the photographs, the six black and whites and the one color photo, all in cheap frames. I was the color photo, the one with the silly mustache and the two long sideburns. I scratched my beard and thought about my professional lineage. Red had retired to ranch in the southern part of the county, had listened to the wind until he had grown loopy as a barn swallow in late elderberry season, and had finally shot himself in the heart. A drunk 14-year-old cowboy had knifed Dell. Otto was crushed under a team of horses, and as near as we could tell, Charlie and Conrad had just disappeared. I knew why Lucian had called it quits. Things had changed in the 70s, and the world could no longer leave his peculiar brand of law enforcement well enough alone. He had ridden the trail for more than a quarter of a century, and that was enough. It wasn't a happy collection of fortunes, but it did help to put Room 32 at the Durant Home for Assisted Living in perspective. The old sheriff was a little roughed up, but he was going to be fine. I had saved a small strand of the hair, but the rest was already on its way to Cheyenne and DCI. I scared up the coffee, folded a paper towel in lieu of a filter, and stepped back to the satisfying gurgle of impending caffeine, and thought about another 9 months in office. Somehow, it seemed longer than the past 23 years and 3 months altogether. I noticed the blinking red light on the wall phone in the hallway, picked up the receiver, and tried to think of what size obituary would say, finally settling on jail.
"It's Bill Wiltsey. He says he wants to talk to you about this Gaskell character."
I punched line one. "Hello? Have you got Leo Gaskell?" I raised my eyebrows and looked at the phone for my own entertainment. "Hi, Bill, how are you?"
He was quiet for a minute, I think for emphasis.
"Do you have him?"
"No, actually I don't."
I looked in at the coffee pot, but it wasn't quite full. "You want to tell me what this is all about? He doesn't seem to have any outstanding—" "He assaulted one of my off-duty officers at the Lander Saloon about 2 weeks ago and broke the orbit around his left eye and dislocated his jaw."
The coffee was ready, so I turned over one of our rare official mugs with the sheriff's star, poured, and watched as a few drops sizzled on the warming pan.
"What's this all about, Walt?"
I took a sip of the coffee. A little strong, but it would do. "Oh, I ID'd a Datsun pickup last night, and we've had someone over here attempting to do that thing that ends all other deeds."
"What?"
That's what I got when I quoted Shakespeare to other sheriffs.
"You want to fax over a copy of your files and a photograph of Gaskell?"
"You bet. Hey, Walt."
"Yep."
"Be careful with this Jaybird. He's bad news."
Leo Gaskell fit the bill, but what connection could he have with the Barogias or Lucian? I would have to deal Leo around like a bad card and see what came up. Just for the luck of the draw, I had put out an all-points bulletin last night. I started up the stairs with my cup of coffee. "Anything on that APB with the HPs?" Ruby shook her head. "Add the plate number." I called back to her as I made for my office. "You find anything on the priest?"
"He lives at the rectory over at St. Matthias. Father Fallon looks after him."
I could go find the old priest, but without Sizer Vittoria, I couldn't do much. I could check on Lana, Isaac, or Lucian at the hospital, head over to the home and ask around, or maybe even call in the Barogia twins and have a little chat. The opportunities were endless.
I swiveled my chair around and looked at the orange mountains that paled to lighter shades in the morning light. The sun was out, but it was doubtful we'd get much higher than the teens during the course of the day.
The foothills were covered with a deep drift of snow that had piled on from the northwest, so that the whole county looked as if it were leaning to the southeast. I knew better than to call the greatest legal mind of our time before noon on a day she wasn't billing on an hourly basis. It was still relatively early, and I needed company for breakfast. I figured the log cabin motel was a good place to look. "What if I want the special rather than the usual?" Dorothy crossed her arms and smiled at me like a magician forcing a card.
"The special is the usual."
I nodded, looked at Maggie Watson, and raised an eyebrow. "I'll have the usual special." She looked to Maggie.
"Me too."
Dorothy opened the waffle iron, set up for Belgian. It wasn't the usual usual. I looked at the menu absent-mindedly and wondered if I were a breakfast, which one I'd be. Probably the usual. "So how are our abandoned safe deposit boxes measuring up?" She sipped her coffee. "Pretty boring, actually." "How much longer do you think you'll be?"
"Maybe 2 days."
It was quiet in the little cafe.
"How's your case going?"
"Don't ask." A thought occurred to me, and I looked at the chief cook and bottle washer. "Hey, Dorothy, who in this county is bigger than me?" She was still, but didn't turn.
"Bigger in what way?"
"Taller."
"Brandon White Buffalo?"
I took a sip of my coffee, glanced toward Maggie, and dismissed that suggestion. "Anybody else?" She sat the bowl against her hip and tilted her head.
"There was a guy in here about a week ago. Construction worker, really big."
"Not a local?"
"No."
"Working around here?"
"Maybe. Outside work, wearing those big Arctic Carhartts."
She motioned to the farthest stool at the end of the serving counter.
"Sat down there. Kept to himself."
Maggie was watching me prime the pump. "Did he say anything that might have given you an indication as to who he was or where he was working?" She shook her head.
"No, he hardly said a word. Anna was busy."
I decided to go with the big indicator. "What did his hat say?"
"I don't read every ball cap that comes into this place. Life's too short."
She poured the batter into the waffle iron, closed it, and then turned back to look at Maggie.
"Asks a lot of questions, doesn't he?"
When they had stopped steaming, she flipped the Belgian waffles from the iron, drenched them in maple syrup, and dressed them with confectionery sugar and a few strawberries for good measure. She slid the hot plates in front of us, reaching back for the pot after noticing our cups were about empty. I started eating as she watched. Dorothy liked to watch me eat, and I'd gotten over it. Maggie seemed to be enjoying her usual usual. "You ever hear of Joly Baroja, the cousin?" She poured herself a cup.
"Some talk about the ETA. He was over there for a few years, during and after the war."
"That's a nasty little terrorist group for a priest to be tied up with."
"Like I said, just talk."
She took another sip of her coffee.
"He must be older than dirt. He did the mass at the Basque festival a few years ago in Euskara. As a matter of fact, I don't think he speaks English, at least not anymore."
She glanced at Maggie, who was doing her best to ignore us.
"You know what they say about the Basques. Like a good woman, they have no past."
I dropped Maggie off at the Durant State Bank and picked up Sancho at the office. St. Matthias is near the creek where the giant cottonwoods tower over the aged stone buildings that make up the abandoned portion of the Pope's compound. They built a new church back in the 60s, a really ugly one, the one I always associated with Pancake Day, but the old rectory and chapel still stood by the creek where they always had. I froze as Sizer Pretoria dipped his fingers in the water, knelt, and crossed himself. I stroked my beard and felt like a Viking, there to raid the place. I followed him down the aisle and passed through the sunlight that skipped onto the hardwood floor. The stone pillars stretched to a small gallery where there were ornate stained glass windows. They were not the usual Jesus lineup, but were odd, with strange depictions of biblical passages foreign to me. At least,
I couldn't remember any parts of the Bible where Goliath stacked rocks or tiny angels flew around people's heads. We shook hands with the amiable blonde-bearded priest and followed as he led us to the kitchen where Father Barogia was seated at a table with some hot cocoa. He paid us little attention as Father Fallon put the kettle on and pulled out a few more mugs. "Jolie, you know you're not supposed to operate the stove without Mrs. Krause." The old priest gave no response. "We had a little accident about a month ago." I sat at the end of the table and studied the old man. He continued to look at his hot chocolate and pulled it a little closer, as if we might take it away from him. He had a long face with a bulbous nose, dangling earlobes, and wrinkles that all congregated at his mouth. He looked like some ancient monk with a heavy wool cardigan that buttoned up around his neck. He could have been any of the hard men I'd seen on horseback in Mare Barogia's photographs. Jean Fallon had warned us that Basque was not his second language or his 57th, for that matter, but that he knew that the language had four distinct dialects and that the vast number of grammatical tenses included a subjective, two different potentials, an eventual, and a hypothetical. I looked over at my secret weapon and hoped we could get out of there before Father Fallon had us diagramming sentences. He brought over some cups for us, and with this ecumenical distribution of cocoa, the old priest loosened the guard on his own. It seemed rude to not say anything to the old guy, so I said, "Hello." He studied me for a moment, but dismissed me for the cocoa. I looked at Father Fallon. The young priest smiled. He can be a little incommunicative at times. "Kaisho sermodus." Cesar Vittoria casually sipped his own hot chocolate and glanced sideways at Jolie Barogia after speaking.
"Serda au."
The gravel in the old priest's voice could have filled a driveway. Sancho set his mug back down with a tight-lipped smile. "Bye." Jolie Barogia's head slipped to one side, and then he leaned in close to Santiago, placing a hand lightly on the young deputy's arm.
"Ongi et torri."
They talked at an impressive rate for a solid 5 minutes before my translator turned back to me. "Was there anything specific you wanted to know?" "What was all that about?" "Cordialities."